Centennial Bankshares versus Utah, case number 19-4092. And Mr. Baird, you're appearing for the appellant.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Bruce Baird. I'm counsel for the appellants. You'll pardon me. I've got to have voice surgery, so I've lost a little bit of my voice. So if I cut out, I apologize. In 1961, Justice Black, in dissent in the St. Regis paper case on other grounds, said that government should turn square corners in dealing with the people. This case is a case about the government not turning square corners with the Centennial Bank, but this appeal specifically is about Utah's rather confusing equitable discovery rule on tolling of statute of limitations. And I say it's a little bit confusing, and I'll get into the case law in a minute. Essentially, the theory of the state and the district court is at any time a lay person gets a order of the court affecting their rights in a way that hurts them, and that order is sealed, the person is supposed to immediately lawyer up, immediately believe that there was something done wrong in the state district court, and fight tooth and nail. And if they don't do that immediately presume that the government has acted in bad faith through the court system, then they are going
to be. I don't know how immediate it has to be. It has to be within the statute of limitations, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And what they're saying,
the individual that received information here was not just someone walking down the street, you know, as you say, a lay person. True, this individual was not an attorney. This person was the president of the bank, and he had been, as others involved in the bank's management, had been warned that the bank was insolvent and they were looking at closing it.
Absolutely true, Your Honor.
So they knew this train was coming.
Absolutely.
And when it came, they knew that they were seized. They knew they were injured.
Absolutely true.
But you think these professional business persons did not have some kind of duty to inquire? I believe
that they did not have a duty to inquire that a reasonable jury could have found that they did not have a duty to inquire, given that the court's filings were sealed, given that the paperwork that was in front of them was taken away from them once they signed the notice of acknowledgement, etc. So yes, Your Honor.
Was the president or other persons involved in the bank management aware of where the documents were that were sealed? Aware of the name of the court that closed the bank?
Yes, Your Honor, they were.
So wouldn't that be the logical place to go inquire?
Well, if they had gone and inquired of that, Your Honor, they would have found that the file was sealed. There's no question that they would have found that the file was sealed. They wouldn't have found that the sealed file was supposed to have been opened on its own 3 days later. It was supposed to have been unsealed. And the reason they wouldn't have found that is because the file itself saying that it was supposed to be unsealed was sealed. So what they're being faulted for is not knowing what they didn't know because they couldn't know because it was sealed. But Your Honor, let me be clear. Could jury under these facts have found that my clients failed to exercise reasonable diligence and were not, in fact, disabled? I will absolutely 100% agree with you that that a jury could have found that as a matter of fact. But all of us who have tried cases know that a reasonable jury can do things that we don't expect them to do. Anyone who's tried a case who didn't think they could lose it but actually lost it, or win it but didn't think they could win it going in, hasn't tried enough cases. So to say that no reasonable jury, remember that's the standard, to say that no reasonable jury could have found that we exercised reasonable diligence.
You're speaking of this as though it's a motion to dismiss. It's a motion for summary judgment, isn't it?
I understand that, Your Honor. And Matt, what I'm asking you to do is take a look at the reverse case, sort of the case that you just heard a minute ago. Assume for the moment that Judge Shelby had ruled the other way, the district court had ruled the other way, and let us go to trial. Assume for the moment that we put on our best case, which is what we're entitled to put on, which we're entitled to have the district court believe up front. assume we put on our best case, assume that a reasonable jury had found that we were in fact disabled and hadn't slept on our rights. Assume those things. Assume that the Judge Shelby had denied a motion for JNOV or a motion for new trial. And we were in front of you with the state claiming that the court shouldn't have allowed the evidence, shouldn't have allowed it to go forward, and that the jury was per se wrong in making its findings that we in fact were disabled and did our best. You know better than I do, because this is what you see all the time, the standard of review on overturning a judge's refusal to grant a JNOV or a motion for a new trial. It's extremely hard. This case should have gone to the jury. I'm not claiming, and would be crazy to claim, that a jury couldn't have found the other way. Absolutely, the state can make a very good case.
Well, wouldn't your argument then work for any case? Every no. case should go to trial, because gosh, we just don't know what that jury's going to do.
No,
we've seen cases just turn out very differently than we anticipated.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the Utah Supreme Court, applying the law that we've talked about here, basically says that the question on equitable tolling is and this is the Myers case, is a balancing test of harm to the parties. There's no balancing test of harm here. There's no issue of what's going on. The documents were in fact sealed. They show the pleadings in front of the district court are where the error is. The question is, what evidence do we have of disability? We showed that the testimony was that in 2014, my clients, as soon as they found out from a whistleblower at the FDIC that there had been something wrong, as soon as he found that out, my clients actively sought to get the documents. They sought them from the Utah Division of Financial Institutions. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your Honor. I couldn't hear you.
Let me stop you for just a minute. I want to back
Your Honor.
When did your client find out that the documents were sealed? And not through a hearsay source, from going to the court and someone at the court saying, that's sealed.
I don't have evidence on the question of when they went to the court to find out it was sealed, Your Honor. Remember, the paperwork was taken away from my clients as part of this action. They had no reason to believe that the files at the district court that the district court had acted inappropriately until they were told that they had acted inappropriately by the whistleblower.
Well, I mean, did your clients agree at the time that their bank should be taken away from them?
Of course not, Your Honor.
Okay. I mean, if you're of the position that this is unjust proceeding in the first place, they were represented at the time, and they believe that their bank shouldn't have been taken away. I mean, doesn't that put them in a position to go to the court right then to see what's being said about them?
Your Honor, I won't dispute that my clients could have done things differently. I'm not going to dispute that. I'm going to be candid.
But we're trying to figure out from an equitable standpoint what they should have done. And equity sort of, you know, brings up reason. And what they have to do to get equity is they have to have acted in a reasonable and equitable manner themselves. Not being diligent is a problem for them, it seems.
Absolutely, Your Honor, it is a problem. I absolutely understand it's a problem. My point is, it is not a fatal problem on a motion for summary judgment. The Utah Supreme Court has held in, let me look at the case, it's a factual determination according to Alki versus Lamer. And I would agree that it's a factual determination. I've been very candid with the court that my clients could lose this. We didn't seek summary judgment on the fact that we were diligent, in fact. We wouldn't have gotten it if we may have said we didn't get it, and we wouldn't have gotten it because there is a factual issue. The question isn't whether we could have won or could have lost. The question is, could a reasonable jury have might have won on a question of fact? And if you take a look at the facts are that my clients were shell-shocked when they were literally stormed with armed guards. Their bank was taken away from them. They have a court order authorizing it. You're right. I assume they could have gone in and fought harder. The question isn't whether they could have fought harder, and that's what I said right at the start. When Judge Briscoe asked her, my point was that given the facts at the time, is my client being faulted for not immediately or even in 4 years lawyering up and assuming that a district court in the state of Utah had done something so wrong as to be a 1983 violation? And I understand the high standard of 1983. I understand the high standard of disability. The point here is that we were denied the chance to at least try to make our proof at the district court. The trial court.
Now you're arguing here, as I understand it, that you needed the documents that were sealed in order to file your lawsuit?
Yes, Your Honor, because without the.
Did you file your lawsuit without those documents?
We filed a lawsuit under different grounds when we got the lawsuit was filed basically to get the documents. Under different grounds, when we got the documents, we immediately amended to bring the 1983 action.
So did you know anything in addition from those documents that you didn't know when you initially filed your lawsuit?
Absolutely. What we knew, Your Honor, is that the state had done nothing to satisfy its statutory burden under Utah law to seize the bank. It was a star chamber proceeding. Basically, the state says, we win, judge. The judge says, okay, you win. It's ex parte. Many of the legal standards that are required under state law for seizure of the bank weren't even attempted to be met. The state did nothing to meet its burden at the district court except to tell the district.
Aren't ex parte proceedings the norm in this situation?
Absolutely, Your Honor, but they have to comply with statutory grounds. And the documents that we subsequently discovered indicated that the state did nothing to meet the statutory grounds for taking over the bank, except to say, we meet the standards for taking over the bank, Judge. They didn't really put on any evidence. They did nothing. And we didn't know that and couldn't have known that until the files were opened. May I reserve unless you have a great question.
First.
So, Your Honor, I'd be happy to answer your question.
It sounds like the problem you have is with the state court ex parte judgment, not necessarily, whether the state satisfied its burden in front of the court. I mean, how does that get you a 1983 claim?
Well, that's a different issue, Your Honor. And I can tell you, we have a parallel case for another bank and not a different United States District Court judge has gotten us over qualified immunity on that case. It's not relevant, it's not relevant to the issue of whether we should have gotten to at least try, Your Honor. If I've answered your question, I'd like to reserve the final 2 minutes, if I may.
Sure.
You may. Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Cliff Peterson, Utah Attorney General's Office. We believe the district court correctly concluded that no reasonable juror could have found that this plaintiff had acted reasonably, that they basically slept on their rights. And if you look at page 15 of their opening brief, their own timeline, now on appeal, they jump from shortly after the bank is seized to 4 years later with this happenstance meeting on a ski lift. I mean, really, if you take their argument to the logical extreme, that discussion on the ski lift could have happened 20 years later, and yet they still get around all statute of limitations just because some happenstance meeting on a ski lift triggers additional. So first of all, I don't think that argument should carry the day. They failed to meet their initial burden to show that any initial disability. When the bank was seized on March 5th of 2010, they knew that the bank had been taken away from them, that they objectively knew this definitive fact. And also, in response to what my colleague just said, if this was so draconian and stressful, wouldn't that have prompted more due diligence? And so if this was so stressful and so shocking, we think that would have alerted the plaintiff to even more action rather than sleeping on their rights for 4 years. So they slept on their rights, and that's what the Utah Supreme Court's cases talk about. We're not going to allow equitable tolling to rescue a plaintiff who unreasonably sleeps on their rights. We believe the district court correctly assessed all the undisputed record evidence and, as a matter of law, determined that no reasonable juror could have concluded otherwise. This was no surprise to the bank. In 2019, they stipulated to a cease and desist letter on this very issue. Under capitalization, there's some serious problems with this bank. And then again in January, just before the bank was seized, 2 months before the bank was seized, they received the FDIC report, again showing serious concerns about undercapitalization. Scott Priest, one of the officers of the bank, testified in his deposition that he disputed both of those. Well, if you dispute both of those, and then the FDIC and the Department of Financial Institutions comes and closes your bank in March of 2010, if you believe that they were wrong and you were right, don't you do something about it? Why would you capitulate? Why would you do nothing? So the record speaks for itself. The facts, we believe, speak for themselves. And the because that's what plaintiff stipulates in their opening brief. The issue is about this initial showing of disability.
Why weren't the records unsealed and released to parties after the bank seizure?
We don't know, Your Honor. There's definitely no evidence that my client did anything to conceal that. Perhaps it was, this is me speculating, but perhaps of a ministerial error on the part of the Second District Court just slipped through the cracks or whatever. We don't really know. But by its own terms, it was only supposed to be sealed for 3 days. And that very limited time period was for a very discreet reason. And that's to prevent a run on the bank. You do this on a Friday afternoon so people don't run, the court can take judicial notice of the problems that a run on a bank can cause. But it's only sealed for 3 days. Let the FDIC take over receivership. And then the bank is over the weekend. They can do with their best to hopefully reopen on a Monday morning. And there's not complete chaos, which is what they avoided in this situation.
Well, presumably the bank has the opportunity to contest or appeal the seizure order, right?
Absolutely.
So what should the bank have done in this case if they felt that the seizure was in bad faith or unjust?
Absolutely. They should have gone to the Second District Court and they should have objected to the closure. They were given notice. They signed, Clint Williams, the president of the bank, signed receipt of service. That's signed, that's actual notice. And we're going to just throw out actual notice and let that stand in limbo for years. So they received actual notice of that. The notices, in addition to that, even if he was shell-shocked and we're going to let him be relieved of his own signature, there were notices placed on all the branch doors that said the Second District Court has authorized the closure of the bank. They knew the court to go to. They could have gone, they should have gone, if they really believed the FDIC was wrong and the Department of Financial Institutions was wrong, and that there was not an undercapitalization problem existing for months and months, they should have objected. They should have filed something in the Second District Court within the 10-day statutory time period and challenged that.
Counsel, what's the evidence in the record about their representation by counsel at the time?
They acknowledge, we've mentioned in our opening brief that they acknowledge that they communicated through counsel. They had counsel at the time. So these are sophisticated businessmen with counsel. We think it would be a disservice to the equitable tolling case law to allow them to sleep on their rights with counsel and basically indefinitely suspend the running of the statute of limitations. When they knew the bank was seized, they knew the court that had done that, and they knew where to go to get more information. Does that answer the court? Was the court asking for a specific record site?
No, I just wanted to know what was in the record, particularly about that.
Yes, there was acknowledged that the bank officer said, we've cited in our answer brief, that his only communication after the bank was closed was through counsel. He acknowledged he had counsel. And also in the deposition testimony, there was statements made that they had counsel. They actually said they hired an attorney after the closure of the bank who went to the bank after the closure to try to obtain more information. There were several references.
Do we have
go ahead, sorry,
a debate as to whether or not the president, in fact, retained the documents that were served on him when the bank was seized?
We know that he walked away and did not take anything. He said in his deposition, this is in the appendix, pages 139, 140, and 141 and 142. He was told not to take anything with him. He was told he could come back and collect his personal belongings. When he was pinned down on deposition about the specific documents, the documents of notice, he said, well, they were on the desk. And when he was asked, what do you mean when you said you they confiscated, this kind of Gestapo military force comes in and takes over your bank tyrannically, what did they, he said, well, confiscated, it was on the desk. And I was told I could come back and get my personal belongings, but I didn't. His personal assistant told him several days later, you can go back now. He said, I don't want to go back. Just bad memories. I don't want to go back. He chose not to go back to get anything. The documents he left on his desk, his personal belongings, he goes on at length in his deposition about his personal photos and his other private belongings, but he did not go back. He turned a blind eye, did not go back, and I don't think he should benefit by being able to say, I can escape the legal consequences of actual notice. Case number, case name, 10-day notice that I can escape the consequences legally.
Was the notice to the president on the date of seizure, was that only given, that is the notice that told him that he had, that he could go to this particular court, notice of need to seek judicial relief, that notice? Was it only a document, or was it in fact orally told to him?
I believe, as I recall, it was explained to him that he could, but it, at the very least, it was in writing. It did say you can.
Did he recall or state that he was orally told where he could go to seek judicial relief?
His testimony was he didn't really remember anything. His testimony, he was so shell-shocked he didn't remember a thing. Whether he was told it or whether he read it, whether he signed without reading, whatever. His testimony was that he did not remember.
Thank you.
But by its plain language, the notice, this is in the record, in the appendix at page 298, it says, I went to the second district court we were county. I got an order from that court. And that is legal notice that's sufficient to place them on notice of where they could go if they had conducted any due diligence instead of sleeping on their rights for 4 years. The district court correctly applied the undisputed record evidence to this case and was correct. And if there are no further questions, we will submit it.
Thank you, counsel. We'll accept that session of your time, and Mr. Baird has some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate Mr. Peterson's argument. The trouble is that the notice of seizure and the notice on the doors is not the same thing as notice that there was a fact of wrongfulness. Those facts of wrongfulness were contained only in the sealed records. Now, I will acknowledge.
What do you think what should we expect under Utah law for a duty to inquire?
Your Honor, I believe that. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your audio cut out for a second, Your Honor.
Further investigation.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your audio cut out for just a second.
When was the duty of inquiry triggered here?
The duty of inquiry, I think, is a factual question, Your Honor, that a jury could determine. There is no argument that my clients could have done more. The question is not whether they could have done more. The question is whether they're going to be penalized by summary judgment for not having done what someone else would have done, what Your Honor may have done, what I may have done. I was not counsel for the bank at the time. I may have done things differently. But when the documents are confiscated from the bank officer, and that's in the record at Appendix 73, paragraph 9, citation is 138, lines 38, 4 to 40, 20. When the documents are confiscated and you don't have the documents, yes, you could have gotten them later. But even if you'd gotten the base documents of the seizure or you had read them on the door of the bank, that's not the same thing as being able to see the sealed file where the inappropriate conduct of the court and the state was buried. And with that, my time has expired. I'd be happy to take any more questions if the court wants to ask any more.
I have only one question. Are you in Monterey?
No, Your Honor, that's my house in Costa Rica behind me. The little white thing is my house in Costa Rica.
Are you there?
Which I can't know. I wish I were, Your Honor, but they won't let people from Utah with rising cases in there. I'm trying my best to get there, Your Honor.
Well, thank you. You made me feel better. I thought you were someplace wonderful.
Your Honor, I really wish I were. And I wish I had my swim shorts underneath this suit and tie. But unfortunately, I'm in the same predicament that we all are at the moment with plague.
Mr. Baird, I have one last question. I've ridden a lot of chairlifts in my day, yet I've never encountered a whistleblower.
You know, Your Honor, the weirdest part is, I understand that, but it happens. I mean, 15 years ago, I was in London getting off a train to make a phone call, and I stepped off the train, and a woman was struggling to get her suitcase on the train, and she looked up at me, and I helped her with her suitcase. There was a woman I had a blind date with in Utah 2 weeks earlier. Coincidences happen, Your Honor, and not just in novels and movies.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Counsel, we appreciate the arguments. I think we understand your positions. You are excused, and the case shall be submitted.